The winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Economics is Richard Thaler. He's an old friend of this program, a behavioral economist at the University of Chicago, whose work has captivated not only academia, but, believe it or not, policymakers. His work tries to lead people, or sometimes nudge them, into making better choices about their finances or health or whatnot. So we thought it'd be a great time to let you hear a piece we put together last year about a unit that was operating in the Obama White House. The unit has since been discontinued. In any case, this kind of unit has been spreading to governments around the world. And while it might be a bit of an exaggeration to say this, let me say it. They probably wouldn't exist without Richard Thaler. Okay, on with the show. Fort Bragg is a massive army base in North Carolina, home to 52,000 active duty personnel alone. And then there are reserves, civilians, contractors, family members, and army retirees. How much money does an army retiree have to live on? Well, it depends when they started saving. Consider a relatively new army recruit, Private Thurman Dixon, still a teenager, just signed a 6-year contract out of high school. He's only paid $700 every 2 weeks, but the Army covers the basics: housing, uniforms, cafeteria food, healthcare, and so on. Which means Dixon can spend most of his paycheck on whatever he wants.
Shoes, clothes, video games, out to eat. I mean, what else do I need to spend money on? I mean, I don't really have any necessities or anything that I have to pay for. So a lot of it's just having fun.
It's a lot more fun than, say, peeling off 10 or 15% of every paycheck and putting it in a savings or retirement account.
I'm a terrible saver. So when I get paid, I feel like I can just blow through the money and that, oh, I get paid again in 2 weeks, so it's really nothing.
Granted, Thurman Dixon is young, so he's got plenty of time to catch up. But it turns out he is not much of an outlier when it comes to retirement savings and military personnel. Only 44% of them enroll in the government's Thrift Savings Plan, or TSP. That's a retirement and investment program for federal employees. Among civilian employees, that rate is nearly double, 87%. Now, keep in mind that civilian and military employees are different populations. The military has a lot of young, low-paid people.
Yeah, but I think actually the greatest reason for this difference is that civilian employees are automatically enrolled in these plans, but military service members have not been.
That's Maya Shunker. We'll meet her more formally in a bit. Shunker's point about participation rates in the government savings plan is really basic. Some federal employees are automatically signed up, and others, like military personnel, aren't. And what would happen if they were? And how would that happen? Well, when we spoke to Private Dixon, he had just transferred to Fort Bragg from the base where he trained. Moving bases is a common occurrence in the U.S. military. When you arrive at your new base, you go through an orientation process. You meet with administrative staff.
Good morning. Can I have a copy of your orders? And did you choose?
You get assigned to a unit. And you fill out a lot of paperwork, a lot of paperwork. The Department of Defense recently decided to use this moment, this lot of paperwork moment, to run an experimental pilot program at Fort Bragg to see if they could increase enrollment rates in the TSP retirement program. Rather than incoming personnel simply being told about the existence of TSP as something they might possibly want to take part in, now they were first shown a video.
TSP is like a 401k. It's an investment program in which hundreds of thousands of service members participate.
And then they were required to make a yes or no decision on enrollment.
Soldiers are actually afforded the opportunity to make a choice, an active choice.
That's Antoinette Jones. She runs the personnel services branch at Fort Bragg.
There's no trickery involved. We have no influence over their choice whatsoever. We just pretty much provide them with the opportunity and the information to make a choice.
This pilot program ran for 5 weeks. What happened? What did the data show? You will learn that and much more right after the...
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
A Department of Defense pilot program at Fort Bragg showed that a slight tweak in how military personnel are exposed to a retirement savings plan, essentially just forcing a yes or no answer rather than leaving it open-ended, this led to an increase in take-up of roughly 8 percentage points.
Which would, if scaled up, help the service members and their families who undertake over 640,000 transfers to new military bases every year.
When we spoke last year, Maya Shunker was running a little-known governmental unit that helped set up the Fort Bragg pilot. Her unit was known as the SBST, for Social and Behavioral Sciences Team.
Which is a group of applied behavioral scientists that works across the federal government to translate insights about human behavior and how we make decisions and how we act on them into improvements in public policy.
Such as?
Yeah, so we're doing everything from helping low-income students go to college and helping student loan borrowers get back on track with their repayments. We are trying to help the reentry population find work and support when they leave prison, helping families in Flint stay safe in the face of the lead and water crisis that's going on. We're also working to help farmers get access to small business loans and to make sure that low-income students have access to school lunches at school.
Shunker has a background in cognitive science, undergrad at Yale, PhD at Oxford, and postdoc at Stanford. It was at Stanford, studying the science behind decision-making, that she got inspired to do what she's now doing. She was having coffee with an advisor of hers,
who told me the story of the National School Lunch Program, which offers low-income students free and reduced-price meals at school. And I remember hearing that, unfortunately, many, many kids who were eligible for free meals at school were actually going hungry every single day because of a burdensome application process. But I was excited to hear that the U.S. Department of Agriculture took steps to eliminate the need for an application altogether for those students whose eligibility could be determined through existing administrative data. And since the policy change, over 12 million kids have been automatically enrolled into free meals. And it was a light bulb moment for me. I realized that this was the sort of work I wanted to be doing in my career. But I also realized that there was tremendous potential to more systematically apply these insights to public policy, and that without a coordinated effort, there was no guarantee that, you know, the latest behavioral science would actually find its way into government. You know, we really needed a pipeline.
Shunker's vision was a dedicated team within government that could range across departments and help test out and apply behavioral insights. Which sounds like a good idea, right? But Shunker was only in her mid-20s and had spent most of her adult life in academia. She sent an email out of the blue to the White House's Deputy Director for Policy in the Office of Science and Technology Policy. In 2013, she got a job as a senior policy advisor. By 2014, the SBST was up and running. How did that happen? Did the president just hand you a bunch of money in an office full of staff and say, "Go for it, Maya"?
Absolutely not. That's not how it happened.
How it did happen was that Shunker built a team bit by bit and then persuaded federal agencies, one by one, to let her team collaborate with them. They began with some pilot projects with the Department of Education, the Department of Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services. They earned a few early wins with simple behavioral nudges, like increasing college enrollment among low-income students by texting reminders to complete certain tasks, like applying for financial aid. They had a similar success with Obamacare applicants. But coming up on Freakonomics Radio, the need for government streamlining is, shall we say, rather large.
So there's the income-based repayment plan, there's income contingent plans, there's the pay-as-you-earn plan.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Maya Shunker is a cognitive scientist who set up in the Obama White House a unit called the Social and Behavioral Sciences Team. They partnered with whichever federal agencies were interested in applying behavioral insights.
And so what we'll do in those cases is we'll start most conversations with our federal agency partners with the question, so what are the problems you're already trying to solve? What are the goals you've already articulated for yourselves? And then we look to the research literature in behavioral science to try to identify all of the tools and behavioral techniques that we might have at our disposal to help our agency partners achieve those goals more effectively and efficiently. And SBST was brought in to help on the development of the handbook and to make sure that behavioral insights were integrated into its content. And we propose a number of different changes, but among them were developing checklists that featured action steps inmates and former inmates could take before release. And the reason why it was so important to distill all of the recommendations into these time sequence checklists is that in many cases, the proper sequencing of actions is very important for preventing setbacks. So, for example, encouraging individuals to obtain a birth certificate prior to release can then accelerate their getting a government-issued photo ID upon release and applying for work. We also addressed individuals as community members versus ex-convicts because we know from social psychology that people are far more likely to act in ways that are consistent with the identity that they associate with. Part of the design process was actually bringing in a formerly incarcerated individual to weigh in on the design of the guidebook, to make sure that we were talking about mental health in appropriate ways, to make sure that we were framing resources in ways that would resonate with this population. And so, again, that's part of the behavioral design process, is making sure that real people have actually gone through these experiences and the challenges associated with reentry have a say in the content that goes into a guide like this.
I guess my greatest curiosity about everything we've been talking about, which is that it feels like you and maybe people within the agencies themselves are trying to come up with fixes to policies that are obviously well-intentioned but just aren't being taken advantage of fully. And so I guess that really is the big question, which is you feel there's a necessity for your unit, and I'm guessing a lot of people would argue the same, but, you know, just as a medical treatment is almost never as effective as a vaccine that prevented you from ever getting sick in the first place.
You're absolutely right, because I think, you know, I would say it's akin to having a behavioral Band-Aid. So you don't want to put a behavioral Band-Aid on a broken program to make it marginally more effective. Instead, you want to come in at the outset to define the fundamental features of the program so that you don't need the Band-Aid at all down the line.
One example of promoting participation by making things simple: the SBST's work with the Department of Defense that we heard about earlier, trying to get people like Private Thurman Dixon at Fort Bragg enrolled in TSP, the government's thrift savings plan.
I'm a terrible saver.
When Shunker first met with the Department of Defense, she wondered, why not just automatically enroll military personnel in TSP?
As would be the first thought of most behavioral scientists is, okay, we have the solution, right? Automatic enrollment is the ideal proposal here.
Which private firms have been doing for 10, 20 years now.
Absolutely. I mean, President Bush signed into law the Pension Protection Act, which facilitated automatic enrollment in 2006. So from a behavioral perspective, automatic enrollment is the ideal proposal. But as you can imagine, proposing a substantial change in retirement policy that's going to affect over a million employees every year is a pretty hard sell on day one. So we began with a lighter touch pilot in which we sent emails to 800,000 service members that prompted them to enroll.
This was in 2015. Shunker and her SBST team came up with an experimental plan, sending out 8 different emails, each using a variant of a behavioral nudge or two, to see what led to the greatest uptake. Some emails emphasized exactly how to enroll. Some emphasized the financial upside of enrolling. The level of personalization varied as well.
And we found from that pilot that our most effective message doubled enrollment rates.
And what was the most effective message?
Yeah, the most effective message was one that was personalized and that highlighted that even small investments today can lead to very large gains in the longer term.
The Department of Defense, Shunker says, was so impressed that it let SBST set up the Fort Bragg pilot. There, service members were approached in person rather than by email and given the TSP form as part of their routine orientation with a yes-no option. No one is forced to check off yes.
But you have to submit the form in order to complete the orientation process, and that's the key feature.
Roughly 12,000 people transfer into Fort Bragg in a given year. This year, one of them was Major Christian Martinez. He's been in the military for 22 years, and he's known about TSP for a long time.
I had my dad work for the Postal Service, and he had TSP, so I heard about it before.
Martinez watched the informational video.
If you have any additional questions about the Thrift Savings Plan, there are links...
And then he was handed the TSP form that required a yes-no choice. After 22 years, he finally said yes.
It didn't really make the decision until right now. The form was up there, the video was up there, it was a trigger point. And yeah, I got to do this.
The nudge worked for Major Martinez. How about for Private Dixon?
Definitely not today. Definitely not today. I think the reason I don't do it is because I can't touch it. So say I put something aside and then I go to spend and I spend all my money and then I want to go touch it, I can't. So that may be a big problem for me and to why I haven't started it yet. But soon, it should definitely be on the top of my list to do it, get it done soon.
One paradox of retirement savings is that the younger you are when you start saving, the better off you'll be. Compounding gains and dividends really are something close to a miracle. But when you're young, your salary is at its lowest, which can make diverting even a little bit to retirement feel like a stretch. An Army private like Thurman Dixon, remember, is only paid $700 every 2 weeks. So I wanted to ask Maya Shunker if the barrier that he said was keeping him from signing up, that he couldn't touch the money, was really the primary barrier. So I'm guessing that there are a lot of military members on the very low end of the income scale who just feel like there's not enough, you know, money to put away and that you may be nicely offering me this thrift savings plan, but it doesn't really provide me that much. So how do you think I can afford to do that if I'm just trying to pay my bills? I mean, sometimes a clever policy solution will actually highlight a different kind of problem than you were planning to encounter. Is one of the problems that military personnel are often paid very, very little?
Well, our work is focused on lifting barriers to access or engagement for individuals who want to sign up for a program or take a specific action but aren't doing so because they don't have access to clear information about the program or are deterred by a complex application process. So sending an email reminder about enrolling in a retirement savings plan is going to make the difference for someone who wanted to enroll but just needed a reminder to do so. It's not going to make the difference for someone who didn't want to enroll because, for example, they were trying to make a down payment on a home or didn't actually have the resources to save.
Still, the SBST's interventions with military retirement funding have been so successful that the Department of Defense is embracing the solution that Shunker hoped for from the very beginning.
We're advising on a new policy change that's going to automatically enroll military service members into retirement savings plans starting in 2018. I mean, it's just been a remarkable collaboration.
I'm just curious about what kind of pushback you may have felt. In Britain, there was this feeling that nudge unit, they're going to tell us how to respond to this, how to buy that, how to decide this, and we don't think that's the role of government at all.
So I think it's important to first point out that every program has a default design. If you go to a restaurant, menu options are listed in a particular order, and we know from research that people are more likely to pick the first option that they see from a set of options. And quite frankly, if you're a veteran and you're asked to fill out a burdensome application form that requires referencing 15 different resources, well, that's a default too. And chances are that those requirements are actually nudging you away from accessing the benefits that you're entitled to. So in other words, programs have a default design that's going to influence people one way or the other. I think that with time, people are starting to realize that we can either use evidence to inform the design process and the way that we structure those defaults to get better program outcomes, or we can kind of leave them to chance or leave them to accident. I think that one mechanism that we've used to make sure that the public is fully apprised of our work and that we're fully transparent is to publish the results of everything that we do. So we publish the results of interventions that worked. We publish the results of interventions that don't work, those that generated null results. We provide really detailed accounts of what every intervention looked like and what the analysis looked like and what the population looked like, because this is a back and forth between our team and the public. And I think this transparency, coupled with the fact that when people actually see what we're doing in practice, they feel a lot of confidence that what we're doing is benevolent and is serving program goals. I mean, you can think about theoretical risks, but when you actually see a team's work documented in a report, it might assuage some of your concerns.
As we noted earlier, the White House unit Shunker was running no longer exists in the Trump White House, and Shunker herself now works at Google in California. But the behavioral science approach to problem solving, as practiced by Shunker and preached by new Nobel laureate Richard Thaler, is not going anywhere. You've heard about it repeatedly on this program, and I'm sure you will again soon. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, is there a better way to think about terrorism? And if you want more episodes like this one, subscribe to Freakonomics Radio on Apple Podcasts or visit Freakonomics.com, where you'll find our entire archive. We will be right back.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
A couple years back, shortly after a brutal series of terrorist attacks in Paris, the Obama White House put together an anti-terrorism summit. If you know even a little bit about White House summits, you generally know what to expect.
Alas, I'm expecting very little of a positive nature. I view this principally as a media event. I hope I'm wrong.
So we thought we'd take this radio show, which technically is a media event, and turn it into a terrorism summit. We'll talk about what's known and what's not known about terrorism. We'll talk about what's working and what's not to prevent it, and what we should be thinking about but aren't. We'll hear from several people who've been thinking about terrorism for years.
Many people might think that we couldn't make the problem worse. Oh yes, we can make it much worse very quickly, as we saw with Iraq.
The problem is we can never get rid of terrorism 100%, in the same way that we can't get rid of school shooters 100%. So we have to be resilient as a country to be able to recognize that the outlier attack doesn't mean that it's doomsday.
Leadership is taking people to a place they wouldn't have gotten to already. You know, if you see a parade going down the street and you run up in front of it, they're not actually following you.
If you want some bad guys killed, I'm your guy. But what I would like to see is some logic attendant to what our tactical moves are, and I don't see any of that yet.
And we also talked with someone who doesn't study terrorism for a living, but is a fairly good thinker. Hey, Levitt, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He teaches economics at the University of Chicago. He admits that his discipline doesn't necessarily have much to offer on the topic of terrorism.
If you turn to economics and what economics has to say about fighting terrorism, it's a hard problem because economics really centers around incentives. And the kind of incentives we tend to use are things like prices or punishment in prison or whatnot. But when people are willing to pay the ultimate price in the form of suicide to reach a goal, they're not the kind of folks that we're used to incentivizing and motivating.
So rather than rely on economists for our unsummit, we reached out to a different set of folks, like Mia Bloom, an expert in security studies at Georgia State University.
Yes, that's me.
And
my name is Robert Pape. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and director of the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism.
I am Nathan Myhrvold. I'm a CEO at Intellectual Ventures, and I'm very interested in catastrophic risks to the planet.
I'm Jack Jacobs, Colonel, U.S. Army, retired.
Jacobs turns up on TV pretty regularly these days, commenting on national security issues. It was Jacobs you heard earlier arguing that political summits on terrorism aren't necessarily optimized for problem solving.
If the government is convening a conference about this subject, perhaps the government may be amenable to coughing up some resources to solve some of the major problems attendant to it. But I mean, that's a scant hope. In actual fact, what you need is leadership in order to solve problems about national security, both domestic terrorism and terrorism from abroad. And it requires a great deal of effort and organization. And if the government is good at things, I can tell you this, they're not good at this.
All right, so maybe we can lend a hand. A good place to start is what we know and don't know about the root causes of terrorism. It's natural to react to immediate events, to the emotions and headlines that accompany them, but let's try to go a bit deeper. We'll start with Robert Pape. Even though he is a political scientist, a field that most of us associate with theoretical work, Pape is a hardcore empiricist, a data freak.
Just as big data has come into our life in sports, our life in the media, so too can big data help to inform at least some of the assumptions and therefore policy prescriptions on national security affairs.
Most of Pape's research has focused on suicide attacks.
I collected the first complete database of all suicide attacks around the world shortly after 9/11. That data went from the early 1980s, when the modern phenomenon began, to just before the Iraq War, 2003. During that window of time, there were 343 completed suicide attacks where an individual killed himself or herself on a mission to kill others.
All right, so what can these data tell us?
Well, the main risk factor people think it's associated with suicide attack is Islamic fundamentalism. Religion, and specifically Islamic fundamentalism, because they observed the attackers on 9/11 were Islamic fundamentalists. Many of the attackers in Iraq, ISIS is an Islamic fundamentalist group. Well, what this research found, really for the first time, is that religion is not as prominent a cause of suicide terrorism as many people think. The world leader during that 24-year period was not an Islamic group. They were the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, a Marxist group, a secular group, a Hindu group. The Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka did more suicide attacks than Hamas or Islamic Jihad. What over 95% of all suicide attacks have in common is not religion, but a specific strategic objective: to compel a democratic state to withdraw combat forces from territory the terrorists see as their homeland or prize, from Lebanon and the West Bank back then to Iraq and Afghanistan today. This idea of military occupation is the leading risk factor producing over 95% of the suicide attacks that we see as we speak.
Okay, so if occupation then is, I don't know if it's appropriate to call it the root cause of the majority.
I think that's a great way to think about it, Stephen. Occupation is the root cause. There are additional enabling causes or secondary causes. So I don't mean to say that this is a monocausal explanation, but it's like smoking causing lung cancer is the root cause of much of the lung cancer that we observe. Military occupation is the root cause of suicide terrorism. And there are two types of military occupation. There is a foreign, very distant or external occupation, such as when the United States occupies Iraq. And then there can also be an internal occupation, such as when one group occupies another group, such as in Iraq today, the Shia-dominated government is occupying the Sunni population in Iraq.
The reason we're talking now, the reason that the world has amped up its interest in preventing terrorism lately is because of the recent terrorist attacks in Paris, which were not suicide attacks and were examples of religious extremism or fundamentalism. So that goes against the components of your research in a couple ways, but I'm guessing you still have something to say.
Well, you know, I guess I'd like to just stop you there for a moment, Stephen, because there's no doubt that religion was part of the cocktail. But now that we know more about the biographies of the various attackers, and it's made possible because the French authorities arrested and prosecuted several of the attackers and actually knew quite a bit about them. So we have depositions about what's motivating them. And I would just point out that what we know about the Paris attackers is that they were powerfully motivated by the Iraq War, by the Abu Ghraib torture abuse. So this isn't just simply a matter of religion. This is a matter of individuals being motivated by seeing harm on kindred populations and wanting to do something to prevent that harm or to ameliorate the harm.
How do you begin to think about dealing with the aftermath if you're the kind of country like us or like France or like Britain that carries out its national security in the ways that it does and perhaps inspires people to hold this kind of grudge?
There's really two things that we need to do, Stephen. First is not make the problem worse. Before the invasion of Iraq, there were about 50 suicide attacks occurring around the world in 2001 and 2002, and only a handful of those were anti-American. Then we thought we'd fix the problem of terrorism by going into Iraq and essentially wringing the Islamic fundamentalism out of the Middle East by democratizing it. Well, what happened by 2007 is that there were over 500 suicide attacks that year, over 300 of them in Iraq, which had never experienced a suicide attack before. So we made the problem dramatically worse.
Given what the U.S. and others have spent on the war on terror, how would you characterize the ROI?
I would say that, unfortunately, it's quite negative. Harkening back to Rumsfeld in 2005, he had a famous line where he asked publicly, "Are we creating more terrorists than we're killing?" And the answer was, in 2005, we were. We not only had invaded and occupied Iraq, most of the public will know about Abu Ghraib and the torture scandal. But in addition to that, we were imprisoning thousands of Iraqis that we thought were connected with the insurgency that was growing. In 2004, the insurgency was estimated to be just 5,000. And then we started to imprison and arrest, and we ended up imprisoning almost 20,000 over the next year and a half. And then we started to kill insurgents. We ended up killing 18,000 over the next year and a half. So that what we did is we thought we were going to go and stamp out the problem with toppling Saddam, changing the political system. When that didn't work, we thought we'd go and stamp out the problem with vicious behavior on sort of the hornet's nests of some of the insurgents like Fallujah. And what those policies did by 2005 is they just made the problem dramatically worse. And Rumsfeld himself saw that.
Hmm. And let me ask you the flip question then. How would you characterize the ROI for terrorists? And let's not limit this to Islamic fundamentalists in the last 10 or 15 years. Let's talk about terrorism generally. It seems as though they force their enemies to spend billions, perhaps trillions of dollars. There are all kinds of less easily measured costs than dollars, all by investing a relative pittance of their own. I mean, it's hard for me to think of a movement or an activity that has a larger ROI, frankly, horribly, than terrorism. It works, doesn't it?
You're exactly right, Stephen. So 9/11, by all estimates, including the 9/11 Commission, costs al-Qaeda less than $500,000. And it produced many billions of dollars of damage, not just in the loss of air traffic over the next year and a half, but in launching two major wars, one of which in Iraq turned out to be extremely expensive, extremely costly. And so there is absolutely no doubt that terrorists have an enormous return on their investment, that terrorists are doing terrorism because they think it pays, and there's evidence that it pays. But that wouldn't work if we wouldn't overreact and help terrorists increase their return on investment. We have smarter approaches to the problem than just simply reacting on the basis of fear and anger and hitting back.
Give me an example of a government that you feel understands and handles, deals with terrorism well.
I'll give you two examples. One is the Basque government. So we used to have in Spain a Basque terrorism problem. That terrorism problem has essentially gone away. It was a major problem for several decades in Europe. And in the early stages, like many governments, the government tries heavy-handed military force to try to deal with the issue. Publics, of course, are afraid and fearful. The publics like to see tough talk and tough action, but that just made the problem worse. And then basically through a series of education and demographic policies, the Basque separatists, basically that political movement disappeared. And it disappeared because the Spanish government stopped treating the underlying Basque community as a separate community and started to have more integrationist and assimilationist policies. In the case of Northern Ireland, with the IRA, the British had an enormous problem with the IRA that really was, just awful. Thousands of people dying in the early 1970s. And the British at first tried to deal with this problem by being very tough. And Maggie Thatcher, who was a very conservative leader of Britain in the 1980s, was known as being a very tough woman. Well, she's the one who started the secret talks with the IRA leaders, which the public didn't know about at the time, but ended up leading to the Good Friday Accords in 1998 that essentially cut a deal for a tremendous amount of political autonomy for the local communities in Northern Ireland, which effectively ended, virtually ended, I guess I would say, terrorism that had gone on for decades. So what we have seen is we've seen a pattern. And we've seen a pattern where states who face terrorism initially want to react with very heavy-handed force. Some force, of course, is necessary. I'm not saying none. But often overreact, make the problem worse, and then over time learn.
Like Robert Pape, Mia Bloom, the Georgia State Security Studies expert, also thinks a lot about terrorism before it happens.
So one of my main approaches is to look at how terrorist groups change and innovate, how they learn from each other, and looking at, for example, changing operatives from males who were suicide bombers to looking at women terrorists, and to increasingly moving into the future, looking at children who engage in political violence. For example, we see children in Boko Haram and ISIS cubs, and we're seeing more and more children who are militarized across the world.
Bloom takes what you might call an environmental approach to understanding terrorism.
If you have an environment in which the young people think that there is nothing for them to lose, and if they've got nothing to lose, becoming a martyr isn't really a high cost, that is a very different environment than if you have a society in which you have very capable young people who think that they have a bright future ahead of them. The push factors are the structural conditions of poverty, lack of education, perhaps occupation. But the pull factors are also things that the terrorist groups are able to offer the individual. So, for instance, many people think it's cool to be a terrorist. There's this jihadi cool associated with being a young person who might travel either to Afghanistan, Chechnya, Bosnia, or now increasingly to Syria.
To that end, Mia Bloom says the internet can tamp down the cool factor as much as it might build it up.
We have some of these jihadis on social media from the UK complaining that, you know, they went to Syria thinking that they were going to be a hero, and all they're doing is cleaning toilets.
Bloom also likes the idea of patrolling the internet.
We need to make sure that the internet is a safe place for young people. So in as much as we police for sexual predators, we should be looking for these jihadi predators. We need to have community policing that is very successful, as well as outreach and supporting communities.
We should note that Bloom's contention that people are pushed toward terrorism by poverty and lack of education is somewhat at odds with Robert Pape's research.
I did the largest demographic profile of suicide attackers that we have. I was able to collect socioeconomic data on 462 suicide attackers, about half of them from Middle Eastern countries. That is the populations we most want to know about. It really shows quite strikingly that the impression we have in the media that suicide attackers are these loners, dregs of the earth, they're uneducated, all religious, are simply not the case, even in the Middle East. In fact, many of them come from quite normal backgrounds and are mobilized by the political anger and the political problems. It's kind of political activism gone wrong.
When it comes to educating the country in general about terrorism, some people think we need a different kind of education entirely.
The world has turned a blind eye towards what I call strategic terrorism, the idea that a terrorist group could inflict damage of enormous consequences. And we just don't seem to be working on it.
That's Nathan Myhrvold. He's a former Microsoft executive who now runs Intellectual Ventures. He writes about modernist cuisine. And a couple years ago, he made some noise in national security circles by publishing a monograph called Strategic Terrorism, A Call to Action. Strategic terrorism is categorically different from what Myhrvold calls tactical terrorism.
For example, a bioterror attack on the United States could easily kill, in all simulations and studies we've done so far, it could kill 100,000 to a million Americans. Meanwhile, a suicide bomber at a mall could kill 10 people. Now, if you wanted to kill 100,000 people with suicide bombers, you would need 10,000 attacks. Frankly, that's not very likely. But it may be possible for a group to execute one attack that kills 100,000 or a million, or maybe even more.
What kind of a bioterror attack does Myhrvold envision?
Smallpox is the one everyone talks about because smallpox is a truly horrific disease. A huge part of the population was never immunized because we drove smallpox extinct. Except there's some labs that have it. And Russia actually produced weaponized smallpox that was probably a much more virulent strain than the wild one. They produced literally tons of it, thousands and thousands of pounds of this deadly, deadly transmissible thing. If a terrorist got their hands on that, or frankly, they got their hands on a natural thing like Ebola, you know, we saw the amount of terror that Ebola has struck. Ebola is actually fairly mild compared to many of these biological agents in terms of infectiousness. That's because Ebola requires you to get bodily fluids on you and in you. Smallpox transmits through the air. So just having a conversation with someone riding on a bus or a plane, you're going to get it. To the degree you have a human-to-human transmissible disease like this and you release it, you create a global pandemic that would shake the foundations of modern civilization. A skeptic could say, look, it hasn't happened yet, so maybe it won't happen. Or someone could say, well, gee, terrorists are more interested in blowing people up at shopping centers or flying airplanes into buildings than they are the things. And I call this the Blanche Dubois strategy. From A Streetcar Named Desire. You know, I've always relied on the kindness of strangers. Well, this is relying on the kindness of terrorists. And it's true that most terrorism is low tech. And it's true that most terrorism is about getting some misguided person to strap a suicide vest on and go to a crowded place. But the 9/11 attack showed enormous strategic intent. It showed tremendous planning. It showed operational discipline. Mohammed Atta, the leader of that attack, had a master's degree from a university in Germany in urban planning. If he'd had a master's degree in molecular biology instead, he could have done a lot more damage.
In Myhrvold's view, the U.S. needs to put a lot more emphasis on strategic threats versus tactical threats, as it has done in the past.
Well, You know, I think the best example is that after World War II, with the advent of nuclear weapons, we split the Air Force and the Navy into both the strategic forces. So that is the Strategic Air Command in the case of the Air Force. It's the nuclear submarine force in the case of the Navy. And those folks deal with missiles that have nuclear warheads that could frankly end the world. And they don't give a damn about anything else. They're not about tanks. They're not about pistols or helicopters or all kinds of other weapons. They're about what are called strategic weapons. Meanwhile, the rest of the armed forces, they're the guys that carry guns and have tanks and ships and all of the other sorts of things that are focused on the tactical stuff.
So why do you think there's not more coordination, whether within the U.S. or between countries against strategic terrorism? Is it a resource allocation issue? Is it a probability misperception issue? Something else? All of the above?
Well, I think it's a lack of top-down leadership. I think that many people in, at least in the U.S., in the military, in the FBI, in the intelligence agencies, many people recognize that this is a possibility. There are people who study it and who work on it, and they do so in their own little silos. And I believe that if there was an attack tomorrow, a future 9/11-like report written by the survivors would say, actually, well, we had this piece of intel on this and this piece of intel on that, and we kind of put it together but not fully. And then, oops, we didn't actually have any protective gear and we didn't know what to do. You know, there's this old truism that generals always are ready to fight the last war, not the one they have to fight. And it's human nature. It's the thing that we actually focus on are the novel, the things that are fresh in our minds, the lessons we think we learned from last time.
Right. But you could say that a lot of things that we do naturally, you know, they're human nature and therefore we accept them, we explain them, we rationalize them, whether it's something to do with how we, you know, treat our bodies, with something we do in society, how we treat the environment and so on. And yet we work pretty hard to supersede that human nature in matters where the stakes are high enough. So how do you do that here?
And that's the definition of leadership. Leadership is taking people to a place they wouldn't have gotten to already. You know, if you see a parade going down the street and you run up in front of it, they're not actually following you. You're only leading if you take them to a place they wouldn't have gone to by their lonesome selves. And of course, we have lots of people trying to supply that leadership at many parts of the government. I don't mean to sell them all short, but I think that the fact that we haven't seen this kind of attack already deeply affects everyone's expectations.
If you ask anybody at the top of the food chain in national security, he'll tell you exactly the same thing.
That's Jack Jacobs, the retired Army colonel. He is a Medal of Honor recipient for his heroism during the Vietnam War.
We really don't have any national strategy. But to be fair, trying to develop a national strategy in this kind of national security environment, where we're just getting started, is probably too much to ask. And in fact, what the National Command Authority, that includes the President of the United States and all the people who directly report to him, including the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so on, what they're doing is solving tactical problems. They're making tactical decisions. In the circumstances, in the absence of an overarching strategy, that's probably all you can do. But I would like to see a summit convened, and not an open session either, by the way, that would determine what our national security objectives are and what are the specific goals we need in order to achieve them. Until we do that, we're going to be playing tactics and not strategy. We're going to be sending drones to blow up guy A or guy B without any idea about what the long-term positive strategy that achieves. I'm not averse to that. You know, if you want some bad guys killed, I'm your guy. I'm strongly in favor of that. But what I would like to see is some logic attendant to what our tactical moves are, and I don't see any of that yet.
What's the difference, Jack, in how politicians view terrorism compared to, let's say, military, law enforcement, intelligence?
Well, I think politicians have a tendency to use the term terrorism to apply to anything that looks dangerous, and particularly those things that we don't seem to have any plans to deal with. It behooves them to categorize almost everything as terrorism. The result of that is that we've ignored some of the threats in which people don't directly get killed, and cybersecurity is one of them.
So talk to me for a minute about that. If you were allocating resources to physical security and cybersecurity and whatever other kinds of security you might want, how might you, Colonel Jacobs, suggest we do things differently?
Well, I'd spend a lot more money, a lot more time, and a lot more other resources, including human resources, attempting to solve the problem of how we protect our data at rest. We're just now realizing that all of our data are at risk. I was talking to a friend of mine who runs a very large retail operation. We were talking about cybersecurity, and I said, well, what do you care? You're just like selling socks or Slurpees or something or other. He says, you must be joking. We're a bank. We have everybody's credit card numbers, banking information, everybody's address or phone numbers, everything about them. So every enterprise, every commercial enterprise has data at rest that needs to be protected, not just the Defense Department or the Energy Department. And so far, we've paid short shrift to that threat. Enemies of the United States, casual hackers, have no problem whatsoever, especially if they've got sophisticated computers, have no problem entering our systems. And the danger is real, and we are just now realizing that the danger is real. I would spend lots more money in that.
So, what sort of advice have we turned up today? As Mia Bloom and Robert Pape told us, the root causes of terrorism are often not what we assume, and this obviously affects how you think about prevention. Jack Jacobs and Nathan Myhrvold warned us not to spend so many resources preventing old-fashioned physical terrorism when the threats of bioterrorism and cyberterrorism may be much greater. Steve Levitt, meanwhile, my economist friend, he too thinks that Americans worry more than they should about the threat of physical terrorism.
I think you just want to start with the basic idea that it is almost zero, that whether it's a little bit bigger now or a little bit less now, terrorism for essentially forever has been just a drop in the bucket of the ways that people can die. And, you know, if you compare it to any sort of health risk like diabetes or heart attacks or cancer or any sort of socially constructed risk like dying in a car crash or even accidents like falling downstairs, in general, terrorism in America is not something to worry about. Very different if you live in Syria or Iraq or someplace like that. Look, terrorism matters there because terrorism is like a way of life. Like, it's really terrorism and you know, the fight for control of government and whatnot are all kind of mixed together. But, you know, if you're American and you don't want to be a victim of terror, if you basically stay in the United States or in anywhere other than, you know, places that are actively fighting for control of government, you're incredibly safe.
Levitt doesn't think that he has that much to contribute to an anti-terrorism summit.
I think it's much easier for economists to come up with good ideas about how to be terrorists rather than how to fight terrorists, because how to be a good terrorist is about thinking what are the things you can do to a society which is most disruptive and most affects either the psychology or the commerce of a country. And it's almost the economic question in reverse, that economists spend a lot of time thinking how to most efficiently make economies run. So I think we're actually pretty good at figuring out how to destroy economies too. And so not that I think any of us are actively engaged in that endeavor, but I do think we would be more useful on that side of the table.
Mm. Okay, so after the anti-terrorism summit is over, if they hold a pro-terrorism summit, you'll volunteer for that?
I'm not saying I would volunteer, but I would say that if ISIS wanted to be particularly effective, perhaps they should kidnap a bunch of economists and treat us kindly and trick us into believing in their mission and take advantage of our knowledge.
Win-win, because then the economists go away, too. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks, as always, for listening. If you'd like to hear more, check out our free weekly podcast on Apple Podcasts or visit Freakonomics.com, where you can also find the books, the blog, and much more. Talk to you next week.